Good morning and welcome to Smashy Business. I'm Lubna Hamdan.
And I'm Richard Fitzgerald.
Is your watch okay there, Richard?
Yeah, my watch hit the table. Sorry about that. The lights kind of were really strong when they just went up on the video show and they kind of caught me off guard a bit.
But yeah, true. It's it also gets very hot in here, which is great because then the guest starts sweating and I get all the great answers. So
is that what happens?
Good news for
I think you make them sweat in a colder environment too, but yeah.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you. We'll go through the headlines real quick. The PIF has initiated talks to acquire the kingdom's national carrier, Saudia, and Apple is discussing using Google's divisive Gemini to boost iPhone's AI. And Abu Dhabi saw a new record for the Emirates' priciest apartment in Nobu Residences. And then popular YouTuber Mr. Beast got a $100 million Amazon deal for a competition reality show. I need to become a YouTuber, gosh. Mm. NVIDIA revealed its latest AI chip, which it claims to be 30 times faster than the previous one. And then will be joined, stay tuned, by the CEO of Creative Zone, one of the UAE's most trusted business setup advisory firms, according to them.
Great. Yeah.
So how has your morning been?
Yeah, all good. No
you started
complaints.
By censoring me and telling me that I can't say my personal views on camera.
Oh,
basically.
We were just chatting about Russian politics and how irrelevant it is to the show. But no, yeah. I actually, before this show, I don't normally prep as well as you do, but I did listen to Mr. Beast's podcast on the back of his tweet because he was like, oh, I was going to do a press release, but I just decided to jump on and do a podcast. So I do have a lot to share on that story, but I think we'll kick off with the other ones.
Yeah, okay, cool. I guess let's get into it because there is a lot going on. We're living through really exciting times, I think. Let's talk about the PIF.
Yeah.
It's in talks to acquire Saudia, the national carrier. And we're seeing a lot of these deals. We saw that with the merger, the Maidan and Nakheel merger into Dubai Holding that Sheikh Mohammed announced just a couple of days ago. And that's going to allow them to compete not just regionally, but globally. It's very exciting seeing the Emiratis making these moves.
Making these moves. You know, look, I saw a statistic the other day where it was like, this region has X number of almost $1 trillion sovereign wealth funds. Mm. And they were like 900 and something billion. There's about four or five of them. And one of the stats underneath it was that in Saudi, they moved more of the equity from Aramco into the PIF. They just moved about another 150 billion. And that made the PIF from like 700 billion to like 990. So it's as if they're sort of trying to create these $1 trillion funds. And if they're trying to create these massive wealth vehicles, then how is that good for the economy? It probably obviously is. And what does that give you as a country? Because in the past, what countries had was budgets. They had national budgets. They had fiscal policy. They had other types of things that they could do with their budgets. Then they had state-owned assets, such as trains, such as airlines, such as stuff like that. Now, this thing, this phenomenon of a sovereign state fund is a new thing. It's a relatively new thing. I don't think Ireland has one. Like, what does America have, right?
Right.
So this sovereign fund is like, it's capitalism, it's private in a way, although it's government owned, and it just allows you to do all this maneuvering. It puts your national budgets on steroids, for want of a better word. It allows you to do all this sort of stuff. And I think when you said at the start, we're in exciting times, this is the really exciting part because not only are these $1 trillion funds loaded, they're also super active. Like in the past, like, you know, Saudi obviously had wealth and like we're told that like Norway has one of the biggest sovereign wealth funds in the world, but who cares? It's Norway. It's vanilla. It's boring.
Yeah.
It's not going to do anything. Just maybe gas in the Baltic Sea or whatever. I don't know. But like, do you know what I mean? And now we've got these like huge, big power play country things going on with. And they can invest in anything. They can buy anything. They can buy tennis for $2 billion just by saying, hey, let's do it and take it or leave it in
while,
like a week.
While the US wasn't taking them seriously, they've been, you know, building their game and doing all of that. And you said, what does that mean? Well, we're seeing what that means. We're seeing, you know, the shift in Saudi, and what a shift it had been. I mean, nobody really saw it coming this fast.
I totally agree. And, you know, the airline thing is interesting because when they announced RUH or Riyadh or Riyadh Air, sorry, the purple nice these designs, because that's all
we've
seen. Which
is owned by the PIF, launched last year in March. Yeah,
launched last year in March, announced their celebration of a year recently, yet they haven't flown a passenger, but they're buying up lots of aircraft. And we could go into the Boeing story, which, you know, Qatar and talked about that yesterday as well, or recently. But so the airline thing, obviously travel, tourism, national carrier, there's a lot to do with transport, a lot to do with. So the fact that they've gone all in on Riyadh Air, and then the national carrier, which has been around for, I think that was in the articles yesterday, 70 years or something, Saudi. So Emirates is like 25, 30 years. But so the national carrier of Saudi has been around for a while. And in countries, right, when national carriers are kind of state-owned assets that are propped up and usually loss-making, whether it's Alitalia or, lots of different national airlines in countries are struggling, right? British Airways, the German one, Lufthansa, many others.
I mean, the British are struggling, full stop.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty sad going to London now, isn't it? When you go and you really see the difference. And, you know, even going to London versus going to Doha. Like, I went to London a couple of months back and it was absolutely depressing. But you go to Doha and you really feel like there's so much going on there. So there really has been a shift.
Definitely. And, you know, Qatar have their national. But I think we have to look at this strategically. Like, is the Riyadh Air, is that going to be the flag carrier, or is it going to be Saudi Air? And if it goes on to PIF, because, you know, so then we have this whole debate in Saudi is like, do you want PIF to own everything? And if they do, then is it all a monopoly? Mm. And how do you stimulate private sector, which is the SME sector? So I think what they're doing is, and I could be wrong, but I think what they're doing is they're having these hero ones that they own to like stimulate activity in the rest of the economy.
Absolutely. And I do think you make a great point about startups, because I do still think that people are not taking them that seriously. Even at the Web Summit in Doha, you know, they didn't even have chairs, most of these startups. And it was the same thing with the STEP conference. They give them these little booths. They're kind of almost an afterthought in the background. You know, I'm talking about the really smaller businesses and stuff. I mean, for God's sake, give them a chair or something.
Well, I think, you know? Yeah, maybe that's the layout of these events, but I see what you mean. You have to pay for it, I think, and some of those smaller startups don't have that much funding.
Yeah,
They're there to get the funding so they can buy the fancy, what do you call them? The fancy stands in these places that cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
But
make it more affordable. But that's what the CEO of Creative Zone is going to talk to us about as well. Apple is discussing using Google's Gemini, which is quite controversial. We saw what happened with the photos that depicted historical figures in an inaccurate way, in an insulting way. People were calling it racist. Anyway, Apple is discussing using Gemini to boost iPhone's AI. Google pays $18 billion a year to be Apple's default search engine for Google Maps. And according to Bloomberg, Google might let Apple license and build its Gemini AI engine into iPhone. So Gemini includes chatbots, coding assistants, etc. for anyone who doesn't know about it, which it's hard not to know about. It's always in the news.
But when's the last time we had an AI regulation story? We don't have any. And like the whole thing is, the reason I bring this up is because the rules have been written now, but the rules have been written by these partnerships and by these investments and by the $7 trillion that Sam Altman is looking for to build his own chips and by the NVIDIA story. This is what's happening in AI. We're told that the regulation is the thing that's going to figure everything AI out. But partnerships is so important. Microsoft, under Satya Nadella, basically got over all their antitrust stuff by doing partnerships. And they became nearly a $2 trillion company by being vanilla with everyone and making deals. And now what we've got is, this is a fascinating story, because Google and Apple have both been criticized with how slow they've been to the AI game. There are commentators who think that Apple are missing a trick with AI, that they don't have a cohesive strategy. And they're also, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of criticism of how Bard, Gemini, and how Google have sort of muddled their AI launch products. Mm. Like it is, you know, Google AI have data for years. Like it should have been the obvious thing that we type in to search
Absolutely.
And to get our AI back. But people are doing it on ChatGPT instead.
Absolutely.
So, but I think this, if this works. Because if Apple didn't have their own data to produce a ChatGPT, and if they partner with Google and they plug it together, then think of how difficult Apple is going to make Sam Altman and OpenAI's life
yep.
on the app device.
Yep.
And they'll get in trouble for it, but they will default Google's Bard and blah, blah, blah. And Google also have their own iPhone ecosystem, sorry, mobile ecosystem and Android. So this is a very interesting move. And Satya Nadella, again, Microsoft went early to do the partnership with OpenAI, but I think I think this could be fascinating if they pull it off.
Absolutely, and it's funny you mentioned they'll get in trouble for it; they'll also get away with it.
Right? Yeah, yeah, they tend to. Yeah,
it's interesting though, seeing you know all these companies, all this excitement going on. You know, we saw it with crypto, then they tightened regulations, and then the crypto guys started coming here to the region. I don't know. It'll be interesting. We've got a bit of NVIDIA news coming up, but yeah, interesting.
Let's say in the NVIDIA one, and we can go back to Abu Dhabi.
About the allegations. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it revealed its latest AI chip. It claims it's 30 times faster. But first, let's talk about the buzz that the CEO created at the conference. It's the annual developer conference. Some people were referencing Steve Jobs. And the kind of, you know, it was more like concert-like, and even the CEO himself said, you know, this is not a concert. Don't think that this is a concert.
Yeah.
There was a buzz in the air.
It's the darling at the moment. He's the new guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Yeah. His name is, let me get it right here.
Huang. I can't pronounce it with an H. Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
So basically, his story is he grew up in... he's from Taiwan. He grew up, he worked, studied, and lived in Thailand, and he moved to the US. And he set up NVIDIA.
Jensen Huang, yeah.
Jensen, sorry, yeah. And he set up NVIDIA in, I could be wrong, but either 1993 or 1999.
Yeah, 1993. Yeah.
And he basically built three companies over the last 30 years under the same name.
Yeah.
Did I talk about the name of NVIDIA on the show before?
No.
The reason it's called NVIDIA is because NV, they used to save their doc files every time they do something as new version.
Oh.
And NVIDIA means envy in Latin. So they were going to be the envy of their competition.
Oh.
So NV is
nice.
New version, NVIDIA. And that's it.
I love that ego. That ego
it's cool,
in business
isn't it?
is crucial.
But is it like a Latin word, but it's also unique? And back then, though, they were in the like Hewlett-Packard competition. They were in the HD, they were in these disks. Like it's very kind of computer compact disc era of yeah. the late 90s. Like that's the type of company they were. And now they're a completely different company. So they're a chip manufacturer and they're a data play, they're hardware. And now they've released a new chip.
And they're the UAE's third most valuable company, which is...
The UAE's or the
Sorry, the US. The yeah. US's third most valuable company. So the new chip is called the B200 Blackwell chip. And they also revealed a new set of software tools as well. It's pretty interesting. I mean, NVIDIA's shares rose 240% over the past year. It's doing really well. Its market value topped $2 trillion last month. It's expecting major customers for both the new chips and the other software.
How much do these chips sell for, I wonder? And how did he do his launch last night? What was the...
It was the annual developer conference.
And what was... It was just the fact that it was like a Steve Jobs-esque show and
yeah,
it was buzzing
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, remember what the NBA and Emirates event
yeah.
happened a couple of weeks ago and you were there and you said it was kind of a Tony Robbins type of atmosphere. I mean, people go crazy at these tech events,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so it was like that. It was a bit of buzz. Cool. Yeah,
I think that.
So basically, like, there was... So OpenAI, Sam Altman, is software, right?
He also invited some robots to join him on stage.
Oh.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. So, but basically, I think what's happening is, like, you know, we had a story up over the weekend that UAE might invest in OpenAI, because yeah. if OpenAI is now a profit company, and but they want to, rather than say Google or whatever, they want to own their own chips.
Yep.
And they don't want to be the software thing, and for NVIDIA to take all the value in the hardware and the chips. So they need. This is why it's unusual to say someone is raising $7 trillion, because no one's ever raised more than $1 billion, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever. Like, you know, startups raise money, but they want to raise $7 trillion. Why? Because they want to take on what NVIDIA have built over the last 30 years. So they want to build their own chips. And Sam Altman, as we showed, he spoke on video at the World Government Summit. He was in Abu Dhabi last year at Hub 71. He's obviously closing up to the region. The region's investing in AI. So they've created a new entity, Abu Dhabi have, MJX, and they want to put up some of that cash of that $7 trillion
yep.
to basically build not only a software, but a hardware competitor to NVIDIA.
Absolutely. It'll be exciting to see. We're running short on time. Should we move on to the Abu
Dhabi
story?
As we're talking about Abu Dhabi,
Because I feel like we can talk about this forever. Nobu Residences in Abu Dhabi set a new record for the Emirates' most expensive apartment. Richard, it's only 1,430 square meters, and it sold for $37 million. It's the Nobu Residences on Saadiyat Island. It's a pretty small apartment for that amount of money.
Square meters, but that's square feet, so that should be 10,000 square feet. That's like a three or four bed.
Three or four bed for $37 million.
$37 million.
I mean...
Yeah. So
it's a three-bedroom penthouse, by the way. It has its own private pool. Occupies an entire floor, etc. But I don't know, for $37 million, is that not expensive, or is it just me? Have I watched too many real estate shows? I've watched Selling Sunset, million-dollar listing in New York, and I don't know
what they're doing down
for
there.
For Abu Dhabi apartments, especially.
Yeah. Well,
no insult to Abu Dhabi.
But this is the thing that they've created. I think out of nowhere in the last 5 years, they've created the supply and the demand. So with Aldar and with other strategic partnerships, like what's happening in Saadiyat there with the Guggenheim and the Louvre and all these developments that have residents as well. And now there's a wider trend of like hotels having residences, but now we see Nobu having residences.
Yep.
But so
I wonder who bought it.
Well, this is what I was going to say. They've created the supply and the demand. The billionaires are buying there. We keep being told not to publish because they want privacy. Mm. But the likes of, I don't know, Bill Gates, Naguib Suarez, these people are just buying places there. Ray Dalio has a place there, right? Like, so these, like, the super 1% of the elite of the world. I think that's why they're... $37 million to them isn't a lot, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's also a Russian singer who is building a house on the Palm, apparently. Anyways, we'll move on to that.
You'll be covering that one later. But yes. I think we have to move on. Sorry.
popular YouTuber Mr. Beast has gotten a $100 million Amazon deal for a competition reality show. I kind of hate this guy because he's 25 years old. He's an American YouTuber.
Jimmy Donaldson. Yeah.
That's his name. He said, it's interesting, you said he didn't want to do a press release. He just went on Twitter, made the announcement for the show, and then did his own podcast.
Yeah, he joined some
which
guys.
Press release should be dead by now anyways.
Yeah, yeah, just come on the Smashy Business Show, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Stop paying PR agencies, pay us.
Exactly.
But like, no, I totally get it. So you undersold him. Like, he's not the popular YouTuber. He's the biggest YouTuber in the world.
He is.
More than any media company, more than any singer, more than Drake, more than anyone.
Yeah, okay, I see you're a fan. So he has almost 240 million subscribers on YouTube, just to give people some context.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say I'm a fan. It's just a commentary, because what I was listening to is, so basically, I think what's happening here is old media streaming services have been doing production budgets for a long time, and now they're realizing that the influencers have the power, so they're partnering with them. But there's a question mark. What you can do with your edit on YouTube, does that work on a streaming service? And he isn't sure, so he talks about the production changes, because he's a YouTube master.
In his podcast,
yeah.
Okay.
And you know, what also, you know, we see with Netflix, they're trying new creative things. So they did a live tennis match, but now they're doing a boxing match between Logan Paul, a YouTuber, and Mike Tyson, and they're doing it as a one-off event. People are laughing at it,
yeah.
But it's getting a lot of buzz.
Yeah.
And so Amazon Prime have kind of come in here, and they can pay billions to get NBA and NFL, but they're going, hey, Mr. Beast, just like Spotify gave Joe Rogan a lot of money. And on the podcast, he kind of drops it. It's like a $100 million deal. A $100 million deal mightn't be cash for him. He reinvests everything else. But he hasn't revealed how much each episode is going to cost, because it's going to be about 10 episodes, right? And it's going to be 1,000 contestants with $5 million prizes. And he said he might even build a city to make the episodes. When he started YouTube years ago, he might do a video for cheap or whatever. A year ago, he was spending $250,000 on a video with everyone he's paying. Now he's spending $2.5 million per video.
Yeah.
To YouTube, and
yep.
And because he's got that amount of subscribers, he makes the money back through rev share, 50%.
Yeah. So apparently he earns between $600 million to $700 million a year, but he doesn't consider himself wealthy and says he reinvests everything.
Every penny, and he lives in the house beside the studio, like he's very basic.
I respect that. I really do respect that. I just don't know how he got the highest number of subscribers in YouTube's history, 240 million, by doing videos like reading every word in the dictionary, counting from 0 to 100,000 for 40 hours straight, and curing 1,000 people's blindness. That's just one of the titles of the videos. I mean,
yeah,
is that what we've come to? I don't know.
I'm actually listening to Like, Comment, Subscribe, a book about YouTube came out about a year ago, and it just talks to the start of it. I think we need to understand youth and YouTube and people like Mr. Beast a bit more. But
yeah.
Just going back on that, so
it I think it summarizes America, though, doesn't it? It summarizes America, because America likes to make. I'm not going to use the word stupid, but not very intelligent people famous.
Okay.
Right? Like the Kardashians built an empire. They've got a lot of money. They've made a lot of money. I mean,
the world populist media anywhere in the world can make stupid people famous.
I don't know. Yeah.
But also define stupid.
True.
Like,
true.
And who wants to be famous? But going back to the YouTube phenomenon and just where we are in media, it's like. People have high brows over types of content, and they're like, oh, that's too, it's not good enough. But actually,
yeah.
People like relatable content. And he knows, he doesn't do crappy content now. He did at the start, like counting to whatever. But now is the creativity that goes into his shows and the production, it is high end. It's just done not in the way that we know. And we're going to see it now in streaming services.
But don't you think he's facing the same problem that media companies are facing as well? Because he is making a lot of money, but he's reinvesting all of it. He's got the highest number of subs in YouTube's history, but he still doesn't consider himself wealthy.
Because
of the high cost of all of those productions. Isn't that the opposite point of doing YouTube?
No, I think you're twisting his words. He doesn't take cash out, so he doesn't have a wealthy bank account. But there are people who would value him at billions of dollars because he's got Feastables, the chocolate brand. He's got the burger chain. And
which he sued. Because they were making raw burgers and bad quality burgers, and it was affecting his reputation.
Yeah.
I mean, for God's sake, like if you want to open an F&B business, surely you know you need to be on top of it, right?
Yeah.
It was made in cloud kitchens and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. These people are strange, and I always feel like there's someone behind them. Like all the Kuwaiti influencers in Kuwait, there's always someone behind them. Just, it seems really weird to me that...
But why is he the strange one? Like, I'm trying to say that...
It's the whole concept of influencing and influencers.
But it's media and it's attention. It's like, you know, say Tucker Carlson or there's a new guy.
But there's value at least in Tucker Carlson's like...
Define value. Like some people like escapism. Some people like entertainment. Kids like certain type of show.
Sure. Absolutely.
Like he's obviously creating a type
absolutely.
Of value that people are willing to exchange their time for.
Yeah. Reading every word in the dictionary is at least that's okay. But some of the other stuff is... I don't know. It's like Mo Vlogs, you know. Why is Mo Vlogs famous? I don't know.
He's a good YouTuber.
I disagree. Like, I can't watch any of his videos, anyways.
But people can, and the stats don't lie, and he knows how to edit, and that's the trick. And if someone masters a craft, well done to them.
Mm, mm.
YouTube is there, at least YouTube is there to reward. Like, there's people who spend loads of time on Instagram and there's no kickback, there's no rev share.
Sure.
So I respect people who figure out to be on camera, to spend time editing, and to figure out the creator economy. The creator economy exists, right? Like, the being an influencer might be a trigger word or whatever, but making content and understanding the economics of the internet and receiving value in return is empowering. Mm. Good luck to those who figure it out.
Yeah, as long as there's value. That's
okay.
it.
Perceived
That's it.
Value. All
okay, right. The CEO of Creative Zone is going to be joining us up next.
All right, stay tuned. I'm out. Bye. Thanks, guys.
Lorenzo Joris, I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Perfectly.
The CEO of Creative Zone. It's one of the UAE's most trusted business setup company, advisory firms. You guys have helped over 45,000 professionals in the UAE, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right.
How is it looking for startups? At the Qatar Web Summit a couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Fadi Ghamdoud of Wamdak Capital, and of course, he's legendary for founding RMX.
Right.
And he said, there's no more free money for startups. Mm. The funding has gone down, according to several reports. How is it looking for startups and SMEs?
That's a good question, and it's good that you have this sort of viewpoint from Fadi. Fadi is seen as one of the fathers of entrepreneurship in the country, in the UAE, in the region, with what he has done and he has achieved. Look, like everything else, funding for startups goes in cycles, and it all aligns to international markets and the flow of money around the world. Due to the increase in interest rates, it's become more difficult for some organizations to indebt themselves and acquire debt in order to go out and invest in things. So the last 2-3 years that we've seen higher interest rates from around the world from the financial institutions, well, the people borrowing money have been a little bit more cautious when it comes to indebting themselves in order to go out and invest in people. So that's why we've seen a slowdown of interest of people wanting to go and take loans in order to go and invest in companies. Nonetheless, there is also a bit of a balance that one needs to analyze, which is the ones that do have money know that they can invest in startups with future growth potential, because the other part that they are analyzing is, what do I do with my money?
Sure.
Do I invest it and put it in a fixed deposit, and nowadays you can get anything between 5 and 5.5%, which is quite a secure thing, and that's why it's high interest rates. So those that have money are going into secure things because are giving high interest rates. Those that don't have money, if they go and get themselves into loan and debt, it is quite expensive for them to do it. So the risk reward for what they are investing into possible startups sort of diminishes. So that's why this is what Fadi is talking about. It's kind of dry out there, but still, you know, the UAE, it's a capital exporter of the world, and there's always money for good startups and good stories.
Is it dry for Creative Zone?
Well, we have different divisions of businesses. We don't mainly invest in startups. We're actually...
You help them set up their businesses,
correct.
Though.
Correct. So we are the largest corporate service provider in the region. We have offices in Qatar, UAE, and Saudi Arabia. Overall, we're about 250 employees, and we help set up about 300 new companies a month overall. This, we do it by providing corporate service solutions where we assist individuals, investors, startups, entrepreneurs, or bigger companies to acquire a business trade license through one of the free zones or the mainlands of any of the seven Emirates. And we also help them acquire residence visas, open bank accounts, deal with their compliance and regulation that today, this is a big topic since the UAE has managed to come out of the grey list from FATF.
Right,
there's a big thing to discuss on that too. But that's what we do in a nutshell as a company.
So how easy, I mean, I'm guessing the UAE is the easiest out of those three, Saudi and Qatar, the easiest place to open a startup, still has its hurdles.
Yeah.
And then how difficult is it in Saudi and Qatar? Because even in Qatar, it's still hard to, you know, get a visa for certain individuals, to get their family a visa. You know, so there are those challenges. Just walk us through that
a little bit. That's a good point. In fact, I think the UAE is the one that is ahead of the rest of the GCC countries when it comes to the easiness of starting up a business. I think the UAE has been working on this for over, I would say, easily 15, 20 years in looking at how they can make things and the processes easier. With the advent of the development of all the free zones that were established here, there's over 54 free zones operating in the country. That shows the strength of opportunity.
Wow, I didn't know that actually. Right. 54 free zones.
54 free zones. So imagine as an investor, as a startup or entrepreneur, you don't even know where to start. Which free zone suits best the type of activity that you want to do? Some of them overlap each other, and it's a matter of you understanding which jurisdiction will give you a little bit more of what you're looking for in terms of either support or visibility or whatever it is that you're looking for. But the UAE has really gone a long way. In fact, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, ruler of Dubai, has recently announced the launch of a new portal called Setup Dubai. We are very proud that about 2 years ago, as a company, we launched Setup Abu Dhabi. Privately, in collaboration with the government of Abu Dhabi.
Nice.
And we created a portal that sort of facilitates the entire journey of one individual or startup or entrepreneur starting up a business that starts from acquiring a trade license, getting all the needed extra things that a startup might need in terms of regulation in certain government departments and permits, then visas, a bank account opening, and so many other areas. But to your question, the UAE has really come a long way compared to Qatar and Saudi. Saudi is just at the beginning of things, starting up. Saudi is, we call it 15 years
over
the UAE. Yes.
Yes.
Than the UAE.
At least they've arrived on the scene, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Late, but worth the wait.
Yeah, indeed.
That's what I always say because I'm always late for everything. okay, so what about Qatar then?
Yeah.
There's
Qatar is a bit of an in-between. I think the thing with Qatar is that they're in a position that they're not, I wouldn't say they're not needing to make it that.
I was just going to say, do they really need it?
You know, they have certain, there are no, I wouldn't say limitations, but they're not a country that they're seeking investment to come in. They're not seeking entrepreneurships to come.
Yeah.
They have limitations, geographic limitations. They are a small country. They don't need, you know, a lot of, so they know what they're dealing with. They want to aim at, you know, the creme of the la creme of the investment. Mm. They don't want anybody just to come in and
Sure. Nobody wants to talk about the Russians, but there is an influx of Russians.
Yeah.
How much is the demand? How much of your customers are Russians? How much have you seen from that?
We've seen a drop of the Russian market over the last 6, 8 months, 9 months. I think the Russian market was very hot for all of us in the UAE, in the real estate industry, but even for us as corporate service providers, we've seen a lot of Russian new investment and new investors, especially new families. We've seen a lot of middle to high to very high income Russian families moving to Dubai.
Yeah.
And they all needed things. They needed property, they needed to set up a business, they needed to acquire residency visas. So we had a massive influx of Russian clients, I would say about a year and a half ago, started two years and a half ago with the conflict. And in the last 6 to 8 months, it has really subdued. So it's a lot less nowadays.
Right. I mean, how difficult is it now for a Russian to open a business? Has it become easier or is it still challenging?
Well, it's a little bit challenging, mostly banking-wise.
Banking, exactly.
The banks have certain restrictions, especially now that we are aligned to international standards and international rule of law.
Right.
So there are certain things that the international law says on how certain countries are having to be dealt with from a policy point of view and restrictions. So the Russians are currently having problems with banking, but also from Russia to other countries. So even themselves, they find it very difficult to take money out of the country.
Of course.
So even if they open up and they open a bank, it's difficult for them to take money out. So this is the restriction. So maybe they are here, maybe they show up and they have cash, and then the banks are like, they don't want to touch them. So
I guess that's where cryptocurrency and blockchain comes into place.
Starts being a little bit of this whole gray area that nobody really understands how to deal with it properly, and nobody knows on which side of the law you stand, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, indeed.
Where are you expecting demand to come from? Are you expecting more demand from Saudi? Has that kind of subdued as well? And what countries are you know, what regions are you seeing most demand from?
No, good question. As markets for us of interest, I think Europe keeps on showing very good interest into the Middle East. I think Europe is going through a bit of a tough time economically. Markets like the UK, France, Germany. And I have to say, a lot of Europeans are looking into this part of the world. They see the glamorous lifestyle and the sunshine and the low corporate tax rates, and they go, you know, let's go and give that a try. And so for us, Europe is the number one market for individuals coming to the country and wanting to relocate here and open businesses. The Indian subcontinent has always been very strong, and that's very steady. Indian high net worth individuals have also been moving a lot to the country, and there's also been certain shifts when it comes to the restrictions and the policies.
Yeah.
Even the UK recently announced some new non-DOM regulations for UK nationals that are living abroad or that have a sort of a foot in and a foot out of the UK, which starts making it a little bit clear what you're supposed to do. And in our opinion, that's going to end up pushing out a lot of British nationals that are going to have to decide whether they end up moving 100% themselves out of the UK. And this is where a country like the UAE is going to end up benefiting a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we spoke about this earlier on the show. It's not the best time right now to be in London. The government is not doing people any favors. The taxes are high.
Yeah.
It's pretty miserable out there, I have to say.
Yeah.
So it's a great time for the UAE. And I feel like, you know, you also see all of these private clubs. We've got the arts club. When the Capital Club first opened, it wasn't as exciting, wasn't as interesting, kind of, you know, failed a little bit. But now you've got all of these new private clubs. It's kind of like, you know, London, perhaps in the 90s, sort of vibe.
Yeah.
Everyone is coming here.
Indeed, indeed.
So it's interesting. Let's talk about some of the pain points for companies setting up, et cetera. Let's talk about virtual offices.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know that you can set up a business and not actually have an office, but you can have a virtual office.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So again, I think the UAE has been very smart on the way that they've been introducing certain policies and structures on the way people can do business. I think after COVID, the world realized that there's a different way on how business owners and entrepreneurs conduct business.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that we all learned is that we need to be very agile, very flexible. We need to be very lean cost-wise, because when you get hit by these kind of sort of downturns, you need to be able to adjust very quickly.
Sure.
So if you have very expensive offices and fit-outs and all these, you know, employees in a jurisdiction that makes it very difficult for you to hire and fire in an effective way, this is where businesses go bust.
Mm-hmm.
So the UAE has introduced very attractive measures. So we have a type of client that we call them the nomad entrepreneurs. These are people that are traveling around the world, that they're doing business. And nowadays you have more and more of these, even social media influencers and marketing agencies, that they work out of their briefcases and suitcases, and they're living in Bali and moving around, and they do pass through London and they come through Dubai and they live in Asia and so on. So they become very lean cost-wise. They can get a trade license in
the
UAE.
Sounds like a dream.
Yeah, for
living
many.
In Bali and working.
Exactly, and
there's
a big market of that. And people all over Europe and Asia and Africa realize you may have an e-commerce company that you're operating out of Accra in Ghana, but you can operate that through a business trade license from Dubai.
Yeah.
You can have a very small or virtual office from here. You can have some staff in Dubai, some staff in Africa, some staff in Asia. So people are operating in this new world, in a very sort of virtual world that is interconnected through many different ways. So the UAE has launched these very exciting products. The same way people used to complain, oh, back in 2008, 9, and 10, when we had our crisis and a lot of people left the country because they had issues with their residency visas, the government said, let's change this. Let's give people their golden visa so that they feel that they're part of this country. So that
Absolutely.
There is a downturn, you don't need to be scrambling to go and get yourself another job within 30 days, because if not, you are supposed to leave the country.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is where the government really adapted a lot of the policy, and this is the results of what we see now.
Definitely. What are some of the challenges for you as an advisory company, you know, helping these companies? What are your challenges as Creative Zone?
I think, look, we love what we do on the day to day. And the more complex the environment, the better it is for us, because we're there to, you know, solve people's
problems.
Headaches. And this is where we come in. So I would say the challenge is that remaining updated constantly with the changes to the law and the regulation and little things. One day, a certain type of nationality gets a little bit more complex to organize a visa. And so how you advise your clients on the day-to-day regulation is what people appreciate the most. If you have someone that is going to come and set up a business and certain type of nationality is having issues with visas, well, it's up to us to inform the client so that not they do everything, they set up a business and like this, or the Russian case, and then later on, the poor guy cannot open a bank account, right? So it's about keeping abreast with all the changes to the regulation. I would say that's one
Absolutely.
Of the main things.
All the crypto guys are coming to Abu Dhabi. They're coming to Dubai because of the tightening of U.S. regulations on crypto. Are we expecting the same thing with AI? Because it is an emerging industry as well. Mm. Are we expecting them to come here as well?
Definitely.
You seeing any kind of demand from AI companies?
100%. I think the reason we're mentioning AI and crypto is because they've been one of the two up-and-coming industries, but it's not related to the industry per se that they're coming here because of that. I think it applies to any industry. I think the reason why so many people are coming here is because it's just more effective and more affordable and more convenient to operate any of these companies. So whether it's a crypto, an AI type of company, even the crypto side, we're still trying to figure it out. We, you know, we set up Vara recently, and there's a new free zone in Ras Al Khaimah called RackDAO that is giving proprietary trading of crypto as a license. So I think we're trying to understand how we go about this. But this, to me, applies to every sector.
I saw on Twitter someone posted, quite a prominent U.S. Businessman, and he posted, "I've moved all of my companies from the U.S. to Dubai because my country doesn't want to see me succeed, and I feel more support in Dubai." It's interesting these kinds of
add to that statements. That perhaps Dubai will only charge him a 9% corporate tax to his earnings versus a possible 20, 25, or 30% that the U.S. will want to charge him. So.
Sure.
It makes a lot of sense for these crypto whales, if we call some of these, to come and cash their wallets in a place that is more effective tax-wise.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Any kind of predictions for the future? What are some trends that we're looking at?
I'm personally very optimistic about what is to come for this country and for Dubai and Abu Dhabi and all the seven Emirates. It's incredible to see how everyone is pushing in this direction. You have places like Ras Al Khaimah with so big ambitions of what they want to create the Monaco of the Middle East. And I personally met Sheikh Saud bin Zayed Al Qassimi.
More exciting than Monaco, though. Monaco can be a little bit boring.
Yeah, well, but come on, you have to give it to them. They created something quite amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have a Formula One and so many other amazing events. But for a place like Ras Al Khaimah, to think that we would be even comparing them to a place like Monaco 15 years ago would have been unheard
Absolutely.
Of, right? So
I mean, the casinos are going to make it all worth the while.
Imagine.
Not a great Ramadan topic, so we'll move past that. But is it true that it's harder to shut down a company and more expensive to shut down a company than to open a company here in Dubai?
It's not as bad as that, but yeah, it is quite high. It's still more expensive to open one But yeah, this is something that we hear quite often from clients and stuff. And this is something that I think very soon the government and the government authorities, the free zones and the different entities, licensing jurisdictions, are going to get to terms with, because it's true that the pricing of closing a company are a bit high.
Nice.
Yeah.
Thanks for your honesty. Is there anything people can do to avoid the higher costs? Is there anything they can do to lessen the
closing cost? A company? No. I would say if you want to avoid making some of these mistakes, make sure that you go in with understanding a little bit the long-term plan of your business. We see a lot of people getting in and out of business, and it's very painful because, yeah, the fees are high. It's like everything else. If you make mistakes in real estate and you pay a lot of, you know, transfer fees and real estate commission fees and stuff, and you're not sure what you're doing, you're gonna. But if you're looking at long term and if you're setting up a business the right way, that's why it's important. Companies like us are advising people on those mistakes that we know usually a lot of newcomers tend to do. So we try to help people by advising them. Don't do it this way, do that, and be careful with certain areas.
Interesting. I have so many more questions, but we're running out of time. Thank you so much, Lorenzo Joris, the CEO of Creative Zone.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stream us, guys, if you want the video version on smashy.tv, our subscription-based streaming service. We've got lots of exciting shows there, sports shows, you name it. Or listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, Amghami, Spotify, or Apple. And we'll see you and speak to you tomorrow.